those of you who may be unfamiliar with our group, we are a group of libertarian and conservative law students, faculty members, judges, and practicing attorneys who are interested in the state of American jurisprudence. We have active chapters at over 50 law schools nationwide. And one of the principal functions of the Federalist Society is to host symposia annually, such as this one. In fact, the Federalist Society was founded at Yale Law School and in 1982 at our first annual symposium. And since then, we have held conferences at Chicago, Harvard, Georgetown, and now Stanford. And these symposia have addressed major topics ranging from the critical legal studies movement to economic liberty. The topic this year is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment protects a remarkable group of freedoms essential to the maintenance of a free society, including the freedom of speech, the freedom of press, religious liberty, and the freedom of association. Indeed, the very fact that we are able to have a symposium like this one depends directly on our ability to exercise our right of free speech and free association. We have organized five panels to discuss what we consider to be five important subjects relating to First Amendment freedoms. This evening, we have Dean John Hart Ely moderating a panel on the political process and the First Amendment. This panel will address issues such as election laws, reapportionment, and the right to vote. Tomorrow morning, we will begin early at 9 o'clock with a panel on the freedom of religion. And this panel discusses both clauses, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. At 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, there will be a panel entitled Freedom of Speech and Press, Permissible and Impermissible Content-Based Restrictions. We have asked each panelist to discuss to what extent content-based restrictions on speech are constitutional, and this would include issues such as libel law, pornography, commercial speech, even national security issues. Lunch tomorrow will be held from 12:30 until 2 in the courtyard of the law school. After lunch, the fourth panel will discuss deregulation of broadcast and telecommunications. The panelists on this panel will focus on broadcast deregulation and issues such as the Fairness Doctrine. The final panel at 4 o'clock will discuss the freedom of association. And the overriding issue here is to what extent private groups can exclude others and also be free from governmental supervision. This year, we have made a special effort to include a broad representation of alternative political philosophies, from libertarian to conservative to modern liberal. I think it makes the debate much more interesting, and it also gives us a chance to practice what we preach about free speech and competition in the marketplace of ideas. The most interesting thing, however, about the First Amendment as the topic for this symposium is that we may find different philosophical alliances falling out of it. Instead of the traditional libertarian-conservative alliance in the economic liberty area, for instance, we may find that libertarians and modern liberals have much to say in common. In addition, I encourage you to socialize with one another. There are over 100 different... That's one of the main points of this conference, isn't it? There are over 100 different institutions represented in the audience tonight from all over the country. This includes different law schools, news reporters, law firms, governmental agencies, and so forth. Socializing has really been one of the most beneficial and interesting aspects of these PANTS conferences for those of you who haven't been in attendance before, and actually it's one reason why we hold them. Some of the most interesting exchanges in the past have occurred over a few drinks at the cocktail parties. One thing that isn't mentioned in the schedule is the cocktail party tomorrow evening at the Stanford Park. Don't miss it. It's at 10 o'clock after the banquet. There's one taker, Richard Epstein. He signed up. For those of you who are attending your first Federalist Society symposium, you'll notice that many of the speakers and members of the audiences are really quite good friends. Some very strong personal and intellectual friendships have been formed at these conferences, and we welcome you into our organization. The most important part, however, about these symposia is that they are dedicated to the notion that ideas are important, and that ideas are important not only in intellectual applications, but also in the way we structure society and the way ideas translate into action. Accordingly, the Federalist Society has attempted to form an intellectual community to facilitate the exchange of ideas, and which includes representatives from all aspects of the legal community, law professors, law students, judges, practicing attorneys, even members of government. Perhaps the best way to describe what is really going on with these symposia is to draw an analogy to the medieval university system. Students used to gather in Florence, Italy, and invite their favorite teachers to lecture to them. The professors were paid directly by the students, and there was a real market system in education. The best and most popular teachers were rewarded and encouraged with frequent invitations. And this is essentially what we attempt to do each year with our symposia. This year, we have imported the best constitutional law scholars that we could find to teach and discuss with us the First Amendment. To the extent that some of you have been invited in the past, it's because we have sampled what you have to offer and want more of it. You are a proven commodity in the marketplace of ideas. For those of you who haven't spoken at a Federalist Society symposium before, we look forward to what you have to offer. But the speakers that we have this weekend have really distinguished themselves beyond the confines of the university. They have successfully combined careers of ideas and of action. They are statesmen in the classical sense. While many academicians focus exclusively on abstract theory, other professionals become so involved in their business or in their politics that they're no longer driven by a vision of how they would like to see society better structured. Now, Dr. Milton Friedman is our keynote speaker this evening, and he is a very good example of such a classical statesman. Many of you who are familiar only with Dr. Friedman's economic writings may wonder what an economist will have to say about the First Amendment. Well, the answer is that Milton Friedman is a pioneer not only in economics and monetary theory, but also in political philosophy. And in part, his true genius has been his ability to convey to millions of Americans, simply and effectively, his idea of a free society. He has persuaded others through his relentless logic to follow his vision of a just society. And this is the role of a statesman and a good teacher, and it is the type of quality that we believe each speaker that we have here this weekend has to offer. I have one final observation regarding the Federalist Society and its annual conferences, and it's this. The outstanding success and attendance at these conferences over the past few years, I think in part reflects a fundamental change in American society. Americans have not only become interested in economic and social liberties, they've demanded it from their government. Milton Friedman put it well when he wrote his final chapter in Free to Choose entitled, "The Tide is Turning." That was several years ago. By now, Dr. Friedman, I think it's fair to say that the tide has turned, and you and the other intellectual leaders present here today are responsible. Well, at this point, I would like to introduce John Hart Ely, the Dean of Stanford Law School. And I'd also like to point out that Dean Ely has been very helpful and should be commended in providing us with these facilities at Stanford and in general for generating a very hospitable atmosphere. Dean Ely and other members of the Stanford Law School faculty have frankly gone out of their way to help us. In addition, it's my good fortune to be able to introduce Dean Ely not only as the Dean of Stanford Law School, but also as a noted constitutional law scholar. He has been Dean of the Law School since 1982. Before that, he was a member of the faculties of both Harvard and Yale Law Schools. In 1982, he was the recipient of the Triennial Book Award of the Order of the Coif for his work, Democracy and Distrust. And now, Dean Ely.
I have two functions. One is to welcome you all to Stanford Law School, and the other is to introduce our keynote speaker. It's going to be an instructive evening, but a long evening, given that we have a speech followed by a panel, so it behooves me to be as brief as possible. As to the welcome part of the speech, let me say welcome. We're very pleased you're all here. I should give you the usual warnings not to deface the furniture if you can avoid it, and keep despite Mr. Brilli's invitation, try and keep the revelries private and consensual, if you would. You're probably all thinking, "Hey, we're Federalists. We don't need this warning about rowdyism, but." I do recall that one of the first Federalists, Alexander Hamilton, was killed in a duel, and we don't need any of that. I know he's not your kind of Federalist, but but if you're going to appropriate a name, you're appropriating a tradition along with it, I think. Seriously, the law school is genuinely honored to have such a distinguished group with us. The organizers have done just a terrific job in putting together what will be an outstanding panel. I doubt that as many future Supreme Court justices have ever gathered in the Stanford Law School Law School auditorium since the graduation of the class of 1952, which we're pleased you're here. My introduction of Professor Friedman can also be brief, since distinguished people don't require long introductions. Milton Friedman is obviously a national institution. Few people have their names identified with an important school of thought. For one thing, he is, as your program points out, a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford University, which is probably why, when you hear his name, I'm sure you think of the Stanford School of Monetary Economics. I have been informed, though, that he has also spent some time at the University of Chicago, and we'd like to mention that. Where he is the Paul Snowden Russell Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Economics. One doesn't have to say much. He's a Nobel Prize winner, an advisor to presidential candidates and to presidents, and we're honored to have him here, Professor Milton Friedman.
Thank you very much. This is certainly a very strange society. I have been accustomed in recent years to other kinds of demonstrations. This is a much more pleasant one. I am not very much accustomed to speaking to lawyers or even putative lawyers, but we do have, as economists and lawyers, we have at least one thing in common. We are, I understand, almost the only two professions which have the characteristic that the supply creates its own demand. I thank Brian Brille and Dean Ely for their introductions. I was told that my function here was to try to put the symposium about the First Amendment in a broader context, and I shall do that. I shall do it by trying to make two main points. I want first to discuss where free speech, press, and assembly, those ideas, fit into the broader context of a free society. And second, I want to discuss very briefly what is the case for a free society. I may say that so far as a label, the only label I like to refer to myself is that of a liberal, but I mean a real honest-to-God liberal, not one of those fake things that go by that name these days. I mean a 19th century liberal, and we have conceal themselves under the names libertarian or conservative, even when those names are thoroughly inappropriate. Schumpeter put it best when he said that the truest compliment that the left has ever paid to the ideas of a free society is to appropriate its label. Let me start out in trying to put it into a broader context by asking a question that I discussed a number of years ago. Do free men make free markets, or do free markets make free men? That sounds like a play on words and like a purely semantic question, but it is not at all. There is some truth, some connection both ways. But there is little doubt in my mind that the much stronger connection is from free markets to free men than it is from free men to free markets. In the case of our own society, one can say that the founders, the framers of our Constitution, the founders of our country, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, were free men, and as free men, they made a society which developed as a free society. But I think if you had asked Lenin or Trotsky, they would have regarded themselves as free men, but they by no means made a free society. Much more important, intellectuals in general, all of whom regard themselves as free men, all of whom are in favor, or almost all of whom are in favor for freedom, freedom for themselves, are by far and away the strongest group in favor of introducing collectivism into society in every other area. Dean Ely referred to Alexander Hamilton, and he's a very good example. Alexander Hamilton, in his report on manufactures, although he gave lip service throughout it to Adam Smith, the report was really devoted to undermining a basic component of a free society, namely free trade. It was a report in favor of introducing tariffs and other restrictions on trade. It was a report that urged a step toward collectivism. So here you had certainly a free man, but he was not working for a free society. And as I've already said, that is certainly true of intellectuals in general. The emergence of free societies has surely been, in considerable part, a result of accident, not a result of intellectual ideas. Intellectual ideas have played their role. They've played a very, very important role. But it's hard to say that they have been the prime movers. In the case of the United States, there is no doubt in my mind that a major factor that enabled this society to be as free as it has been for as long as it has been was something which had nothing to do with ideas. It was a panic of 1837. Those of you who have studied American history will know that back in the 1820s and 30s, there was a great outburst of governmental, industrial, manufacturing, and other enterprises. The states built canals. Illinois, Indiana, other states had set up banking systems which were state-run and state-controlled. There was no ideological objection that stopped widespread intervention by state governments primarily, not the federal government, into economic activity and economic projects. But fortunately, in retrospect, though the people didn't like it at the time, there was a great financial panic in 1837 in which all these great state enterprises went bust. And that gave state socialism, to give it its modern name, a bad name, and had a great, enormous impact, in my opinion, on the future development of the United States. Had more to do with the government staying out of business than did the wealth of nations, even though the wealth of nations gave the ideas which justified the course that we followed. In Great Britain, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. It was 70 years before the repeal of the so-called Corn Laws. As you know, corn referred to all manners of grain. The campaign which was put on in the prior decades and which ultimately led to the repeal of the Corn Laws was carried on in terms of the idea that you had a group of grasping, selfish landowners who were exploiting the ordinary people. That was the idea behind it. That was what gave passion to the striving for eliminating the tariffs on corn. And the repeal of the tariffs on corn, this sentiment that the ordinary people were up in arms against the grasping, selfish landowners who are expropriating the rent and who are keeping prices of foodstuffs and basic foodstuffs high. This resentment, which led to the repeal of the corn laws, established free trade, and if there is anything that is extremely obvious, it is that it is extremely difficult without tariffs to prevent free competition. Indeed, there is no area in society which is more important from the point of view of preserving a free market than freedom of competition in international trade. And it's not an accident that when in the 20th century Britain moved away from a primarily private enterprise society and started to move in a socialist, collectivist direction, tariffs came back. Restrictions on foreign trade came back. In fact, they were one of the early elements in the rise of the modern welfare state. There is a direct connection between free markets on the one hand and free speech on the other. This is part of the story of free markets making free men. The interferences with markets constitute and produces an interference with free speech. Let me not put that in pure abstract terms, but give you some specific examples. Suppose you compare the tycoons of the 19th century in the United States with the tycoons today. With few exceptions, today's tycoons are not very colorful people. They are people who wear three-button suits and go down to Washington to get the best deal they can from the government. You very rarely hear them speaking out against any government program. The tycoons of the 19th century, when government played a much smaller role, when spending by the federal government amounted to 3% of the national income instead of to some 30% now, those tycoons were much more outspoken. They were characters, and they didn't hesitate to express themselves. No businessman today, no major businessman today in our country has free speech. He wouldn't dare to speak freely. Let me illustrate with a couple of quotations from the Wall Street Journal of just a couple of weeks ago. This is from the Wall Street Journal of February 26, 1986, and it's from an editorial. Quote, "It is not clear that any federal regulatory agency has more power to intimidate the people it regulates than the Food and Drug Administration. As a consequence, few active medical researchers in the United States will publicly criticize the FDA bureaucracy. Earlier this week, a small California pharmaceutical company was the latest to learn how high the costs can be for having the temerity to take public issue with this agency. And 2 days later, in re a discussion about small artificial hearts and a ruling that the FDA had brought out that those small artificial hearts intended to be used for women were not to be used, clear case of sex discrimination. I quote from again from the Wall Street Journal, "It's crazy and bizarre that we've gotten into this circumstance with this regulatory agency making medical decisions," said one of the heart surgeons, adding, quote, "I don't know if I wanted to be quoted on that, because I have to live with those guys." A few years ago, when you had when the government was controlling the oil industry to a greater extent than it is now, after the Arab cartel got established, the price of oil went up, and the Carter administration introduced price control on oil. I shouldn't say they introduced it. The price controls were a hangover from President Nixon's price and wage control measures of 1971. The one area where they weren't taken off was oil after the OPEC entry. But then you had this system of allocations and so on, very extensive government regulation of the oil industry. And I got a letter at that time from an executive vice president of an oil and gas association. She, needless to say, did not want her name used publicly. Quote, "As you know, the real issue, more so than the price per cubic feet, is a cubic foot, I guess it is a continuation of the first, is the continuation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. With increasing regulation, as Big Brother looks closer over our shoulders, we grow timid about speaking out for truth and our beliefs against falsehoods and wrongdoings. Fear of IRS audits, bureaucratic strangulation of government harassment is a powerful weapon against freedom of speech. Well, just stretch your minds to that and think of it. Another one of my favorite examples of what I regard as an extraordinary infringement on freedom of speech has to do with the selling of U.S. savings bonds. The situation is not so bad today as it was about 5 or 10 years ago when inflation was sharply on the rise, and when to buy a U.S. savings bond, you were guaranteeing yourself that you would end up after 25 years with less purchasing power than you started with when you paid for it. I used to call it the biggest bucket shop operation in American history. And yet, every bank almost in the United States, those of you who have been depositors of banks, I'm sure have seen this, would receive in one of the monthly statements a little brochure telling how they ought to buy U.S. savings bonds for their own future investment and to promote the country's welfare. And moreover, there is, and this still occurs, every year there would appear a big advertisement, a full-page advertisement in all the major newspapers of the country by the Businessman's Committee on Selling Government Savings Bonds, with all their pictures of the president of this company and the president of that company. At the time, I went around and asked a lot of bank presidents, I say, would you advise a customer of yours whom you were advising on a personal level to put any of his money in U.S. savings bonds? And he would say, of course not, it's a terrible investment. And I would say, well, tell me, why do you send out this misleading advertising that's provided to you by the Treasury Department? And to those who are on this committee, why do you serve on this committee? And the answer was universally the same. The Treasury and the Federal Reserve wouldn't like it if I didn't. Now, do those gentlemen have freedom of speech? Did any of those bankers have freedom of speech? You may say, well, he just didn't have any guts. He could have gotten up and made a speech about what a fraud was being perpetrated upon the American public when they were asked to buy savings bonds with interest rates of 4 or 5% when inflation was at the rate of 8 or 9 or 10%. He could have done that. But it would have imposed a very heavy cost. There ought to be some cost in engaging in free speech. You aren't going to say that there's no free lunch and there's no free speech. But the costs ought to be reasonable. They ought not to be excessive. And they are excessive. Well, you may say to me, but after all, what are you worrying about? That's only businessmen, and it doesn't matter if businessmen have free speech. That may not be the attitude in this room, but I assure you it would be the attitude in a lot of places. But it isn't only businessmen. Let's look at academics. How many academics, how many medical people who are engaging in research on the basis of grants from the National Health Institutes, NHI or whatever it is, how many of them who may privately believe that that is not an appropriate way to spend the taxpayers' money, how many of them would get up in public and make a statement saying that NHI ought to be abolished? And even if they hadn't any research grants, how many members of the law, of a medical school would feel that it was consistent with their future professional career and to come out against government subsidization of research in medicine? I know in my own field of economics, some years ago, it was proposed that the National Science Foundation gives grants for research in economics, and it was proposed that the National Science Foundation should cease giving grants in economics or should reduce the grants in economics. A bunch of my professional colleagues in various universities wrote a letter, a public letter, in objecting to that and claiming that, of course, economics should get grants from the National Science Foundation. I wrote a column in Newsweek in the form of an open letter in which I said I thought that there ought to be no National Science Foundation at all and it oughtn't to give grants in anything. And I cannot say that I was very popular with my fellow economists. But I was able to say that. Why? Because I was a tenured professor approaching retirement. And about the only people in this country today who really have effective freedom of speech are tenured professors approaching retirement. So you can see that there is a great deal of relationship between the freedom in the marketplace and freedom in other aspects, and that, moreover, the freedom in the marketplace is what produces freedom elsewhere. It's because in the marketplace, transactions are fundamentally anonymous, because people are cooperating with one another because both sides benefit. Because in the marketplace, individuals do not have the power to coerce other individuals. It's because of that that the free marketplace is such an important element in a free society. Brian Brille said that we had entitled our final chapter, incidentally, he misspoke, it's not my book, it's my wife's roses and my book, joint book, we were joint authors. But of course, you know, this sex discrimination continues even here. Well, Rose and I entitled the final chapter of our book, The Tide Is Turning, and he said the tide has continued to turn. That's right, in respect of the tide of ideas. The tide of ideas has turned. There's no question about that. Things that today you can get a great deal of support for, you could not get a great deal of support for 20, 25 years ago. Those of us who 30 or 35 years ago were a very small beleaguered minority no longer are. But if you look not at ideas, but at the facts, at the nature of the world, of the United States in particular, the tide has not turned. The United States today is a less free society than it was 30 years ago. Government has expanded in every dimension. Government spending has gone up as a fraction of income. Government taxes have gone up as a fraction of income. You have had a proliferation of regulatory agencies of every kind. Fewer people today have effective freedom of speech. And then, you know, there are the other components of freedom. We as intellectuals may emphasize freedom of speech, but to the majority of people in the country, the freedom to buy what you want to buy, the freedom to live where you want to live, the freedom to be employed as you want to be employed, are at least as important as the intellectual freedom that is so important to us. And in those aspects of society, people today are less free than they were 30 or 40 years ago. That is because, it is precisely indeed because of this cumulative movement toward a less free society, in my opinion, that the tide has been turning in the intellectual area. It's precisely because the growth of government has made more apparent its defects, reinforced as it has been by such dramatic examples as the failure of collectivism in Russia, and in every other country where it's been tried. Those have caused a change in ideas, but as yet we have still the battle to fight to get that change in ideas translated into a change in the realities of the real world. Now I want to go back and touch on the second main topic I wanted to say a few words about. In everything I've been saying, I've been taking it for granted that a free society is a right kind of a society, that that's what we ought to want, that's what we want or ought to want. And we do have an obligation to try to spell out a little bit why we believe that. Now, obviously, that's a subject of immense depth and subtlety and profundity that I'm not going to be able to, I'm not competent to deal with fully, but I thought a few comments might not be inappropriate. It is in fact the case that a free society is a more productive society than any other, that it releases the energies of people, enables resources to be used more effectively, enables people to have a better life. But that's not why I am in favor of a free society. I believe and hope that I would favor a free society even if it were less productive than some alternative, than a slave society. It's fortunate that it's not, because the only reason why there's a ghost of a chance of having something approximating a free society is because a free society is so productive. The enemies of a free society, the forces that are working against it, are so strong that the only thing, in my opinion, that prevents them from conquering is that a free society is so productive that it tends to overwhelm those other forces if given half a chance. I believe I favor a free society because my basic value is freedom itself. My basic value is the absence, and that I define freedom as the absence of coercion of one person by another. Or, if you want to define it in a positive way, freedom of individuals to engage in voluntary cooperation one with another, so long as they do not affect parties that do not consent to the activities they engage in. That seems to me to be the most appropriate definition of freedom. And the question is, how can I justify that preference? How can I justify saying people ought to be allowed to go their own ways and not be interfered with by others? How can I justify the notion that people should be free to sin? If I really knew what sin is, I couldn't justify it. And of course, all totalitarians, all people who have suppressed freedom have done so because of the arrogance of their believing they knew what sin was. The Ayatollah knows what sin is, and that's why women in Iran must not walk around without having their faces covered. He cannot let them be free to do otherwise because he thinks he knows what sin is. Now, you can answer that by saying, well, that's not right, because there's no merit in not sinning. If people are prevented from sinning by coercion, there's only merit in not sinning if people don't sin because of their own desire. But that is, I think, a very superficial approach if you really know what sin is. So in my opinion, the real case for a free society and for freedom is ignorance, is the fact that we cannot be sure we're right. That if I cannot persuade somebody by reason and argument and talk, if I cannot persuade them to agree with me, what right do I have to force them? How can I be sure I am right? I have always been fond of a quotation that is attributed to Cromwell, but which, of course, he meant for the benefit of others, not himself. And he said, I beseech you by the bowels of Christ. No, I got that wrong. By the bowels of Christ, I beseech you. Bethink you, you may be mistaken. I think that states the essence of the case for a free society. In short, the basic virtue in a free society and the basic justification for a free society is humility. There's a willingness to recognize that no matter how strongly you may believe you are correct, you cannot be sure. And therefore, you do not have the right to force it on somebody else. Now, in conclusion, I want to give you two examples to illustrate the relation between the different aspects of freedom I've been talking about. The freedom you will be concerned with in the rest of this symposium, the freedom that is protected by the First Amendment of speak, to write, etc. Some years ago, I received a letter from an academic at a university in Pakistan, which read as follows, and I quote, "I have been delving into the political philosophy of liberalism and individualism and have read whatever little in the, on the subject is available in our libraries. It has been my great misfortune that your highly popular work, Capitalism and Freedom, is not present in the libraries of this country. Exchange control regulations in this country prevent me from buying it from a publisher in the United States. Now I ask you, was that a restriction of his economic freedom, of his political freedom, or of his intellectual freedom? Or can you logically make a distinction? Is our United States system a tariff protection, a restriction of our economic freedom or of our intellectual freedom, of our political freedom? I think it is clearly a restriction of all. Now, I want to give you a hypothetical example, not a real one, as such as that is and has been. Every tobacco company in this country is required to put a warning label on cigarettes, that smoking cigarettes may be harmful to your health. It's taken for granted by almost everybody. I suppose if there are exceptions, they are all in this room. It's generally taken for granted by everybody that that is not a violation of their free speech. Now, there is little doubt in my mind, and I'm sure most of you will agree with me, that far more lives have been lost in the past century as a result of Karl Marx's Das Kapital than from smoking cigarettes. Would it therefore be appropriate to require every copy of Das Kapital to carry a warning label reading this book may be dangerous to social and personal health? Now tell me, where's the difference? And yet, is there any doubt that there would be a great outcry at that suggestion? That would be regarded as clearly an interference with free speech, as clearly an interference with the right of people to read what they want to read and so on. But I challenge you to find any significant difference. Needless to say, I'm not a defender of cigarettes. I quit some 20-odd years ago because I was persuaded by the evidence I read. But I quit because I was persuaded. And I don't think it's any business of the rest of you to tell me that whether I ought to quit or not. Finally, let me summarize everything I've been saying by saying that for an effectively free society, we need the First Amendment, and we have, but we need a parallel amendment at least as much. And that parallel amendment should read, Congress shall make no laws forbidding voluntary acts between consenting adults. Thank you.